chance that a sudden sun discloses, for the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
No! All right, you just heard X with I Got a Fever off of Alphabet Land. That came out a few years ago. Before that, we had One Way Ticket. Brand new Rancid came out this year. Tomorrow Never Comes, the name of that release. And started, of course, with Bread and Roses, Already Dead, band that put that out. That is their take on a labor movement song that was back in 1912, involving the city of Lawrence and a strike. I'm going to play a song now by Paul Westerberg, and it's, I don't know if anyone's ever heard this, because I got this, someone sent me this, and basically the gist of it is, Eric Salt sent me this, and it was a first act music series that used to go on, and there were in-store acoustic shows, and Eric was the sound and recording engineer for this particular session, I guess, and the thing I found funny was he said it was a bunch of Berkeley kids. And none of them really knew who Paul Westerberg was. I mean, of course, we all do. But and if you can hear, this is kind of a grainy audio. But at the beginning, you can hear Paul ask for a request. And Eric says, Alex Chilton. And he plays it. So this is kind of, I just thought it was cool. So I'm going to play that.
With a spoon. If he walks from Mars, then that'd be cool. Set him right on campus, would he stamp us in a file? Hanging down in Memphis all the while. Children by the million sing for Alex Chilton. He comes around singing, I'm in love. What's that song? I'm in love with that song. Slavery, rape, and pillage in the village of his choice. Visible man won't be seen without invisible voice. Feeling like $100, shingin' good lucks face to face. Checking your stash on the trash on St. Mark's Place. Children by the million sing for Alex Chilton. He comes around singing, I'm in love. With that song, I'm in love. With that song, never travel far. Tarot card, falling asleep with a pop-pop video on. If he walks on Venus, would he feed us with a spoon? If he came from Mars and died, be cool. Children by the million sing for Alex Chilton. He comes around singing, I'm in love. With that song, I'm in love. With that song, I'm in love. With that song, I'm in love. When I'm wrong,
clean amp. Thank you. All right.
Wow. Okay, so I just played the Pixies off their doggerel album, Who's More Sorry Now? Kurt Baker song. I forget the end of that title. First few words are, she doesn't wanna. I forget the end of it, though. But anyway, it's really a thrill for me to have Rick Barton here. I was telling Rick off air, the Outlets were one of the first, two or three bands back in the mid-80s, so like 40... plus years ago that I was hooked on, and I went to see him as often as I could. He's still one of the best live shows that I've seen, now or then. And I like all your work, and we'll talk about most of it, all of it, but just thrilled for me to have you in here, so thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, it's...
I've heard that Outlets refrain from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't know we were good. We were drunk. And we were just getting up there and playing and having fun. And, you know, so now, like, 40 years later, people say exactly what you just said. And it's like, man.
But and at the time, you didn't realize it.
No, at the time, we didn't realize it. And my brother, who I started the band with, he always had a little, we'd get there at sound check. For some reason back then, like, I go on tour now with my band Continental. Yeah. We don't even do sound checks. We just show up at the place and play. But back then, like, back then, especially in the local music scene, you took it real serious. I mean, real serious. It was like a concert. Like, we'd go to see the Neighborhoods at the Main Act in Lynn or someplace like that. It was like we were going to a big, big show. And obviously, Dave Minahan was a star, and that band was incredible. But, you know, so we'd get there and we'd do sound check wherever it was, the Rat, the Channel, Jonathan Swift. I mean,
so many.
Jumpin' Jack. Yeah, so many clubs. And so my brother would come off the stage after we do our sound check, and he'd go, "That's the best we're gonna sound all night," because he knew that Walter was gonna start just pounding like as much alcohol as he could drink. I was gonna get as wasted as I could drink.
It was gonna get messy.
And my brother never really did get, because he had to deliver the goods. He was the lead singer and everything. Every once in a while, if he had like a little disturbance in his life, he might tip a few over and have a drunken show, but very rare. But the rest of the band, we were falling apart. But we had the songs, and evidently we had the energy and the spirit of the time. And so we didn't know, you know, because then the party would continue. And back then we were playing, you know, at least twice a week around New England, maybe three times. I remember the neighborhoods back in like 1979 or something. They played like 300 shows all around New England. Like,
yeah.
Now you could never do that. Bands could never even come close to that.
Yeah.
They'd be lucky if they could do 30 shows in a year around New England.
And so, you played a lot with the neighborhood. You played. You and the Hoods played together on a lot of bills, right?
Yeah, we used to back them up.
Yeah.
Quite a few times.
How old were you when you and your brothers said let's form a rock and roll band?
Well, it was right towards the end of '79. I had actually my family moved to Florida for 3 or 4 years in the '70s, which was cool. It afforded me the opportunity to see AC/DC on tour twice with Bon Scott, which I wouldn't have had if I was up here. But I saw them on their very first tour, August 8th, 1977. But anyway, we had moved back, and I was a kid, I was like 17 maybe, but I immediately started going to stations like this station. You know, at the time it was ERS, MBR, because that's just what I like to do. I like to find different stuff, especially after being down in Florida where it was just mainstream and that was it.
Yeah.
So I came back in March of 79, and my brother was a pretty accomplished guitar player then, like playing in cover bands. We had a little band that we played once in a while, but I stunk, and I called him up and I go, "Dave, you do not know what is going on here." I go, "We could be on the radio." I had heard like 3-chord rock by Unnatural Acts, and I had heard this music, and I'm like, "Nervous Eaters just hit," and I'm going, "This is unbelievable." Like, I couldn't believe it. It was like shocking to hear all that incredible music. And so he came right up. We really weren't sure of the direction. Mm. We couldn't get into the clubs. We were too young. We were like 17 and 18.
Yeah.
But
you knew you could do it.
We knew we could do it. At that moment, we knew we could do it. And so we went out. We found this kid in Rockland, the town we grew up in, Rockland, Mass. His name was Mike White. They said, "You got to find this guy. He plays bass." And Whitey was like a hippie. He had wicked long hair down to his waist and everything, and he had this old hippie van. It was cool. And we said, "Well," and we were hippies too. We had long hair back in the 70s. Of course, everyone did. Yeah. And then we all cut our hair to become punk rockers. Right. But I said, "Well, we had already cut our hair." So I said, "We got to cut this guy's hair."
Yeah, I always remember your hair.
Yeah, and so we convinced him to cut his hair. And then there were the three of us, and we go, "Okay, we've got to find a drummer." And we went on this pilgrimage one night. It was a Friday night. We were actually more looking to party, but it was in the you know, it was that summer of '79, and we found this. Somebody told us about a keg party out in the middle of the woods down in Pembroke, and we go, "Okay, that sounds good." And we used to go around with my brother's little crate amplifier and his guitar in Whitey's van because we were gonna try to find someone. It didn't matter where we were gonna find him, but we descend on this scene out by like a lake down in Pembroke, and it's in the woods, and there's 15 people up on the stage. They've all got guitars and basses and stuff, and there's one drummer sitting there just pounding beers, and that was Walter. And all of a sudden, like, and he was coming up with these little beats with like the hi-hat and the kick drum and stuff, he's going, "Come on, does anybody know a song?" And he's like, and Walter was all like, but no one really knew a song. They were all just kids, like up there. So I said to my brother, I go, "Dude, that drummer is unbelievable." Like, just from watching him do that and the way he was drinking the beers, like really fast, like pounding them one after the next. So as soon as they had a little break in the action, which the action wasn't very much action, I came up to him and I go, "Dude," I go, "my brother knows how to play songs." And I go, so that's how it got started. Whitey, my brother, and Walter, and then they needed another guitar player, and I said, "Well, I stink, but I'll do it anyway." And I was going to be the manager, I think, at that time. And then I stepped into rhythm guitar, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
And somehow we immediately got on the scene. We got an audition night at the Rat. We were playing with two like hard rock bands, Balloon and August.
Yeah.
This was 1980 by this time.
Yeah.
You know, I think we had a little gig in someone's party in their basement back in like December of 79.
The sheer energy. The energy of you guys had a great energy, and Dave was still one of the best front men I've ever seen.
Yeah. He was great. We, like I said, but we didn't know.
Right.
So after the audition night, I came up to the guy booking the Rat, Alan, and I said, we want a real show now, with Mission of Burma or La Peste.
Yeah, the demands.
Yeah, well, I was wasted, so I had courage. Like, I had courage. Yeah, everything was revolved around being drunk for some reason. Everyone was wasted, so it was a great party, and it was all good. But, you know, Alan called me up on Monday. I think our audition night was on the weekend, but he called me up, and he goes, I've got you guys a gig on a Friday night with Mission of Burma and La Peste. And I said, that'll do. And then, you know, the rest is history from there.
Yeah.
But it happened quick.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, like, if it was luck or if it was me being drunk and having the courage to come
up. You had something. No, it wasn't luck.
But I mean, just to get in the door, you know what I mean? Like, we got in the door instantly. It didn't take a long time. It just happened right overnight. We were in the door playing.
Songs. They were great. Did David write all the music?
Yeah, he was writing them back then.
I mean, fantastic songs and just a great band. And, did you end up getting a deal of some sort of record deal?
Yeah.
And is that how it came to an end?
Yeah, kind of. We got roped into that whole, like, Boston band gets signed, and then they lose all their energy, and they make a lame record. You know, the Nervous Eaters did it, and they were trying to make the bands have a hit, a radio-friendly song. They'd slow down all your tempos. Clean up your sound. It didn't work because you have the Cars, okay, but you're not going to duplicate the Cars.
Right.
The Cars are the Cars.
Right.
They have their sound. So I think that's the way it's been historically since the beginning of rock and roll.
Still is, right?
Yeah, it still is. So they find something that's a hit that appeals to people,
yeah,
and then they try to create more of it. And I mean, you can't blame them for doing that. So that's what labels do. They've always done it.
It takes some of the authenticity, the energy out of what you're initially doing, I think, right? When they try to, like, water it down or commercialize it, for lack of a better word. And
yeah,
I just think it drains it sometimes. And it's hard to capture a great live band on stage.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to capture.
We were out in L.A. doing a couple of shows, and this guy from Elektra came to see us. And he goes, is there any way we could not do that record you're putting out and do a live record? He goes, because you guys are one of the best bands I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But we were already locked into the contract, and that wasn't going to happen. So, But I would have loved to have heard a live Outlets album.
Yeah. But, no, you guys were great. Eventually that wound down, I guess you'd say. And
yeah, after we had a good 10-year run, and then, you know, towards the beginning of the 90s, we never made it. Back then, the objective was to become a big band, and
and
the punk rock world.
Very few do.
Very few do.
I mean, you're in a majority of everybody, pretty much, that was trying to get that. And, I mean, that I think you need a lot of luck to really, like, break out, so to speak.
Well, I don't know about the luck.
There's some great bands that, for whatever reason, they don't hit it. Is it the timing? They just don't.
I don't know. I mean, look at Nirvana. You know, they had the whole package, obviously, and the star, the big giant, like, incredible songwriter. And but I still think, although I heard, I don't know, I don't follow bands or get too in depth with them, but I've heard that he was a real taskmaster and he really knew
Cobain?
What he was doing. Yeah, and he was organized more than people knew. That's what I've heard, but I don't know. I've never read a book on them. I've just heard someone mention that one time. But nonetheless, money gets put behind the band. Money has to get put behind the band because you've got to get 9 million people to buy into something.
Yeah, okay.
And you can't get 9 million people to buy into something if you're just, like, slugging it around in your town.
Exactly.
That's just not going to happen.
Exactly.
So you've got to hit the road first and foremost. This is what I learned being in my next band, Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah.
You've got to get right out on the road. That's paramount. It just has to happen. You have to tell everybody in the band you're abandoning your life. And I know that Nirvana did that. They were in a van.
Mm-hmm.
And almost any band that ever makes it, they were in a van.
Yeah.
They were originally. And they did it, and they usually got in the van pretty quick. Because
it's the only way you brought in your appeal, right?
Yeah.
Is to get out there and get to more people and... How long of a delay was there between the Murphys and the Outlets?
The Outlets finally. I mean, we played a show here or there, but we essentially were done by '92, and then December of '95. I'll remember it like it was yesterday. Kenny came up to me, Ken Casey from the Murphys, and we were actually going to AA meetings together. Okay. I don't know how many people know that, and it doesn't matter anymore, but the band formed around an AA meeting because we were all ex-drunks, me, Kenny, and Mike. And he said, hey, can you, me and Mike want to put a band together and I'm wondering if you could show us some songs. And I'm like, wait a second, these guys are like 25 years old. And I was like, why would they ever want to put a band together at 25?
Like you're old.
Yeah, they were already old. I was like, and by that time, I was about 34. I'm 10 years older than them. And I was like, they're crazy. I go, but I'll do it. I'll humor them. Yeah, I like them. I go to these meetings with them.
Nice guys.
Yeah. And I dragged out the old Les Paul and the old Marshall amp. And I brought it down to this like barbershop basement in Wollaston. And it was horrible. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. It was brutal. And they were bringing in these drummers. So Kenny was going to play the bass. I would tape all the notes to the back of his bass to show him, you know, where he had to land his fingers.
Yeah.
And Mike, I would just say, just come in yelling, because I knew that he had something special, but I wasn't sure what it was. But I knew we had to corral it just a little bit. But they were bringing in drummers that just couldn't play the drums, and I was finally like,
drums always seems the last thing to get the drummer.
Well, I just couldn't. I couldn't handle it without having a real drummer. So I brought in a drummer, Jeff Erna, and that's when things. And then we ended up making a demo tape. But once again, I thought we stunk, and some people were like saying. And we recorded our first demo, which went on to be like the first big album. But you know, people were saying, "Oh, you guys got everything. You've got the front man, the look, the sound, the songs." And I'd be like, "Are you crazy? We stink." I didn't, and once again, I didn't know. When you're in it, it's weird. You don't know, I don't think.
That's funny, because those are you just banged out two great rock and roll local bands, and at the time, and when you're in it, you're thinking, I don't know, we're nothing special.
Yeah, you don't know it.
Right.
I mean, I think the Rolling Stones might have known that they were special.
Yeah, some people do, right.
And I've heard one time an interview with Tom Petty, and he said that he knew the minute he was hitting the first couple of chords that it was going to be a hit. He knew when he was writing a hit song. He didn't even have to think about it. He'd know it was going to be a hit.
Wow.
But I think that's pretty rare. At least I hope it is. I hope people don't have preconceived notions of their project. It's better to fall into something and be surprised.
But with the Murphy, do you draw right away? I mean, must have drawn right away.
There was a sound guy at the Rat. His name was Alan Kraut. And we were... Kenny got us lumped into this thing where I thought punk rock was over. Like I thought it was over and dead, and I had no idea. And then, I mean, I'm jumping ahead real quick, but we'd be out in California playing shows, and there'd be like 500 punk rockers, and they were more punk rock than the punk rockers from when
I know what
punk
you mean.
Rocker. Like they were just more outrageous.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Had better fashion sense, and they were wild. But you know, so we would be playing these bills at the Rat, like an all-ages show on a Sunday with seven or eight other bands. So this sound man, Alan, he'd come up to me and he'd go, and I'd ask, he'd say, you guys, it's not the same old refrain. He goes, these other bands stink. And he goes, but you guys have songs. And, I mean, I used to like some of those bands. Hmm. They were fun and they were kids, you know what I mean? But so I started getting an inkling. Yeah, and then people latched onto us right away. Once again, it was just like with the Outlets.
Yeah.
The Murphys, people latched on, but in even far greater numbers.
Sure.
And, you know, we'd go to Buffalo. We'd go out to do a show, like go down to D.C. or something. And there'd be like 400 kids lined up. And we'd be in the band. And I'd be thinking, I wonder who we're playing with. And it didn't really, because I had never experienced that in my entire life of playing music. Yeah. Like going somewhere and there was a throng of people there
for
to
you.
See you. Yeah. So I was like, wait a second. They're actually coming to see us. They're coming to watch me. This is unbelievable.
That's probably pretty rare to have two bands, your first two bands, so to speak, and people right away were like, wow. I think that's probably a rare thing. That's cool.
It is. It's very rare. And, yeah, sometimes when I think about it and my history and everything, it's just, I've been a lucky guy. I love to say I've been a lucky guy. I've done so much in music. It's incredible. I'm still doing it. And I put the luck a little bit ahead of the skill, but, you know, I still do. But I put the work ahead of the luck and the skill.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a worker. Like, I, you know, I'm always making up songs. Every time that I'm not climbing up a ladder to paint a house, I have a guitar in my hand. I bring the guitar to the jobs, and it's just like melodies and songs pour out of me still all the time. Like, I don't even know what I've never. Writer's block has never occurred to
me. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because most people do. They'll be like, I had Nat Friedberg in, I don't know if you know Nat.
Yes.
A few months ago, and it hits him. And I said, so when does it hit? Are you like, do you write, wow, I'm never going to write a song again? And he was like, yeah. It does happen. So it does happen to some people where he's like, wow, nothing for like a month or two. And he's, I'm like, so you've never had that though? So
no, I've never had that. Maybe I'll experience it someday and I'll freak out. But, for now, it's like I actually have the opposite, because if I'm really, really tired or like I know I have other things to get done, I can't even look at the guitar because the song will start jumping off the guitar.
You got to get away.
I can't. If I pick it up, it's over.
Done.
Because I don't practice the guitar. I just start strumming and then singing, and that's what I do. I don't like this week. I had to practice because we have a show coming up Friday night.
Yeah,
with
we'll
my
talk
band
about
Continental.
That in a bit. Yeah. Talk about the show as well. Yeah.
Oh, did you want to play some music? I know I'm talking.
I'm gonna play some outlets and some drop kicks, and then we'll get on to your other bands. But so the drop kicks just kind of again that eventually just came to a close.
I can tell you that story.
We'll do that after.
Let's do that after the song, because there's a really nice, beautiful story about that.
Yeah, I know it, and I know from what I've heard and read about you that. It did end on a good note, but
no, it ended on a bad note, but then became a good note.
The Murphys ended on a bad note, but then
my involvement with the Murphys ended on a bad note.
But then it
there was a nice, beautiful end after that initial bad end.
We'll discuss after these outlets and a couple outlet songs. And I could play 15 outlet songs, but you know, I'm not. I'm playing a couple.
I'll fall asleep.
Yeah, I'm just playing a couple. All right, we'll be back in a bit.
Nice to I describe it for people is my dad shot himself and the bullet hit everyone in his life. It was a week before my 30th birthday and I had this impulse to call him, but I didn't because I thought I could call him later that week.
65 Americans a day die by gun suicide. Safe gun storage saves lives. Learn more at infamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
face down in the gutter, won't admit defeat, though his clothes are soiled and black. He's a big, strong man with a child's mind. Don't you take his booze away. Hey!
There you have it, Dropkick Murphys with Barroom Heroes and a couple by The Outlets, Wired and Best Friends. Back here with Rick, you wanted to kind of put a cap on the Dropkick things before we play some music?
Yeah, well, one thing I was loving that, that's a great song. Mike sings the hell out of that one, but I was loving my guitar tone. There's a quick story. Lars Fredrickson from Rancid was our producer. We kind of initially, we were going out to California, and my old buddy Curtis from Tang was going to sign the band, and we had given him our demo tape. Actually, it was our initial EP or whatever. And I said, but I had heard this album by a band called The Business. I'm sure you know them.
Yep.
And Lars had produced it, and I loved the sound of it because I just I love punk rock when it has a really nice sound, and it sounds like rock and roll, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean, and not like all crappy.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So, and I loved that record, so I told Curtis, I go, we have to get this guy Lars Fredrickson to produce the record. So Curtis sends him the music. This has never happened in the history of music. The package that Curtis sent with a couple of t-shirts too, we were trying to lure this guy in. Tim from Rancid intercepted the package, listened to it, and fell in love with us and called us up and offered us a 3-record deal to be on his new label, Hellcat, which was basically Epitaph.
Yeah.
And we were like, all right, well, this covers everything. We're going to be on the biggest punk rock label in the world, and we're going to have Lars Fredrickson produce the record. So anyway, one day when we were getting ready to track the guitars, we had done pre-production for about 10 days at my garage on Center Street in Quincy. And he goes, you're going to have to get a... a Marshall 900. And up to then, I was like, Lars is great. He has great ideas for vocals. He's really like a super talented musician and all of that. And he was a good producer for us. I said, but there is no way. I don't know if you know about equipment, but I had my my JPM, JMP, JCM 800 or whatever, like, you know, 100 watt amp, the good stuff, right? And I'm like, this guy wants me to go get one of those crappy JCM 900s. There is no way. So I feigned a search. Yeah. And I just got in my truck and I drove around, but I didn't really go to any music stores. Right. And I didn't try to find an amp because I go, there is no way. And the studio was already booked, so I just came back and I said I couldn't find one of those amps. We're going to go with this one. And thank God, because I was just listening right there at the end of that song, the Bar Romero song. My tone is perfect, like incredible. And in fact, on the next Murphy's album, whatever that one was called, why am I drawing a blank on that? Well, the second one, my guitar tone is even better, and Lau's produced that one too.
Wow.
But, that's the only story I'm going to tell about the Dropkick Murphys. Let's move on. But I love the Dropkick Murphys. Kenny and I had a bad falling out. We reconciled. We're very friendly now. I'm good friends with the whole band. They're great guys. I love to go see them play. They took my band Everybody out on 3 full U.S. tours. And they're great representatives of Boston.
Yeah.
I know some people that are in my old punk rock scene from my first generation don't particularly care for the Murphys, but that's just not their cup of tea.
Yeah.
But as far as like being a representative of our region and stuff like that,
I think they're
a very positive influence. And I actually love the Murphys. I love going to see them. I have fun when I go to see them.
Yeah.
And so that's that.
I'm glad that ended on a good note.
Yeah, the story is ongoing too.
Yeah. Let's hit on Everybody Out.
Everybody Out. Oh.
And that's another. You always get like new players.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, like, you know what? That's one of my favorite things in music since I've been kind of like a solo artist. And in fact, I love. And I never tell anyone what to play. I love bringing in. I love playing with great, hearing different drummers, different bass players, different guitarists, and
Because Everybody Out had a different sound.
Yeah.
And, everything's got a little different sound that you do.
Yes. I make up the music, and then I just love hearing what people bring to it. It's just, that's my most pleasurable thing in music, is just to hear people dig in and what they bring and how they change the song and make it even better than I had ever envisioned it. And it happens on a pretty consistent basis. So I think I lay down the groundwork, and then they bring it home.
Everybody Out, was that just the one?
We put out the one full length. We put out a couple of EPs. And we were working on a great acoustic record that I had laid down all the tracks for, but the singer, he lost it, and he just lost it. And he was such a great singer, and
he just didn't want to do the acoustic thing.
No, he wanted to do the acoustic thing. I mean, he lost it from the touring.
Oh, okay.
He became resentful towards me because I was a taskmaster and I was trying to do too much.
He was burnt out.
He
couldn't do it.
I think, if I had been a different personality type, we would have gone all the way. But so in other words, I didn't know how to treat him or deal with him well enough, and it was kind of my responsibility because I was the leader of the band.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the face of the band. Well, we both were, really. But, I should have. But when you're in a band and when you're starting to take off and you're touring and everything like that, there's no time for like, psychologically analyzing everyone in the band and trying to figure out everybody's moods and, does this guy like this? Where are we going today? Like, he doesn't like to go there. They don't like to go there. It's like, sorry, it can't be done that way. You have to have, like, there has to be a leader, and then there has to be a bunch of followers, and it can suck.
I bet that's common, too, though.
Yeah.
I bet that leads to a lot of band issues, is just trying to figure, not the psychological part of it all, with all your members, all your players.
The psychological part can be brutal. Can be brutal. And you sometimes, and it's happened to me, you basically just turn into an instinctive animal. You just know, like, okay, we got to drive. Like, today we got to drive 1,000 miles. And then we're playing. And then, you know, and you just don't, and you know you're playing every night. And there's no escape from that. You have to keep going and going and going. And so if somebody suddenly can't deliver the goods or something, you have to... I mean, our singer one time, I had to take him out of the hospital, bring him up on stage in Milwaukee. This was a classic. So he went up there. He was like, he didn't want to play.
Just get out of the hospital.
He was in the hospital because he had some problems. Right? And the guys in the band were saying, you got to sing. You know the songs anyway. You wrote them all. And I go, I'm not singing. Because up to that point, I had never been a lead singer of a band, and I didn't want to sing. And so I drove to the hospital, and I pulled him out. I detached all his like tubes and everything, and I go, you're coming with me, and you're singing. And I go, and not only are you singing, we used to open the sets with Billy Cole, and it would just be me and him on stage.
Yeah.
And I go, not only are you singing, but you're not going to say anything about this situation. You're just going to sing. We get out there. He goes out in the Johnny, in the hospital Johnny, with the bandages, and he gets up there and he goes, hey, baby.
Come on. Johnny on?
And we were backing up the Murphys at this sold-out theater in Milwaukee. And now I get to laugh at it. It's funny, and it's great theater. And he was up there, and he was, like, pointing to the, you know, the IV that had been in his arm, like, hours ago. And he's like, Ricka pulled me out of the hospital and made me come here. And I'm like, I'm going, sing, sing. And I'm, like, strumming the song, and I go, just sing. And he just kept, like, into me, and we ended up doing the set, but it was great, you know. And those are the moments that I know that he still hates me to this day, but I don't hate him.
No room for hate.
I think he was
just drags you down.
He was very difficult to deal with, but he was a beautiful man going through a tough time.
Right.
And he's a beautiful man today. I don't keep track. Him and I haven't reconciled.
Yeah.
I tried once and it didn't work. So
sometimes you got to let that go too, and in your own, like you said, you don't harbor any of it, but there's only so much you can do to reconcile it. And
but I do take responsibility for not treating him better. I think I was
at the time.
Yeah, I don't think I handled it well, and that's life, though.
Yeah, and that you mentioned lead singing, and that brings me to, and I told you about this on the way in, and the Shadow Blast is who you're like, wow, I don't even know if I have any of that stuff. But I loved that. Was that just the one release?
Yep. That was right when I left the Murphys in 2000. And I found these, great musicians, guys from the Swingin' Stakes, my friend Paul Kohansky, Jimmy Gambino, Joe Donnelly, Craig McIntyre, and Billy Lusigian, one of the most legendary guitar players in Boston. And we put out that record.
I love that record.
Well, thank you very much. That was my first like foray into the whole lead singing thing.
That's what I was gonna say.
And and I took to it. I mean, I've become a much better singer than I was then. I was kind of a screamer, but.
I think that we'll talk about, obviously, your soul.